This podcast of Snap Judgment is supported by MailChimp. More than 3 million people and businesses use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com.
From PRX and NPR, it's a special Snap Judgment Live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We've saved you the very best seat in the house. It's about to get started. Enjoy the show.
So, I was driving on the Golden Gate Bridge, and all of a sudden, I couldn't breathe. It felt like there was a tourniquet squeezed around my neck. I was trying to get some air. I was finally able to pull over. I opened the door of my car. I flopped on the ground. And this woman, she runs over and she's like, "What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? Can you tell me what's wrong?" And I did know it was wrong. But no, I couldn't tell her. Because the truth was, I had broken the Golden Man. Welcome. The Snap Judgment. So, when I was a teenager, I used to do a lot of stupid things. I would run up to women I had no business speaking to. I would move to countries I'd never heard of before. I would threaten dudes that were 3 times bigger than me. And it was because of a trick a monk taught me. He said, Glenn, if you've got stress here, move it over here. If you're feeling something you don't want, put it on someone else. Imagine someone. So I imagined a golden man. Looked just like my monk friend. Only had gold nose, gold hair, gold teeth. So if I was feeling upset, I'd put it over on him. I was feeling shy, I'd put it on the golden man. When I was feeling stressed, he felt stressed. And I could go about my business. It was a pretty good deal. Except for, there's a catch. I could never look the golden man in the eye. He tried sometimes to sneak up on me. I didn't let him do it. Didn't let him do it for years. Never caught me. Till one day, driving on the Golden Gate Bridge, not too long ago, I looked up in the sky and I saw him blink. I couldn't breathe. I called my friend the monk. I said, "Look, what do I do?" He said, "You need to go home." I went home. Figured that maybe a shower, some soap and some water, it'll fix this. I was in the shower, and I saw the golden man blink at me from the tiles. I passed out, and I'm wondering, is it gonna be like this?
am I going to be in a spot where I'm running from ghosts in my own house? I was scared to open up doors. I was scared of what might jump out from behind cabinets. It was becoming crippling. He said to go home. Go home. And I thought about it. I thought, go home. Maybe, when he said go home, he meant to go back to where it all started. Maybe what he meant was, it's time I chase some Midwestern thunderstorms. Maybe it's time I got in the field with some Michigan fireflies. Maybe it's time I put a little Zingerman's deli up in my belly. Maybe it's time my kids got to meet their grandmother. Maybe it's time I got to hang out with my uncles on the porch and eat some barbecue. Maybe it's time me and my cousins play basketball again. Maybe it was time I came back home. Maybe it's time I came back home to where it all got started. And you know what? Ever since I've touched down here in Michigan, ever since, it's not the golden man chasing me. It's been me. I've been chasing the golden man. It is so good to be here, Ann Arbor. It is so good to be back home. It is so good to be back and see everybody. I am so happy to see all these people. My mama's here today. My best friends are here today. My cousin's here today. People I grew up with from a little kid are here. Jen White was here today. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't tell you how happy we are to be here. And I didn't come alone. Oh no, I didn't come alone. I brought some friends. Please say hello to Mr. Alex Mandel. To get right with yourself, the dangerous David Brandt. Tim Frick. Our next guest tonight is the second best looking bald-headed black guy in tonight's show. All right. He's the first best looking. A former Grand Slam moth champion. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mr. Shannon Case.
If you died today, where would you go? I used to do what's called street evangelism. That's when you go out into the crowded streets and basically you annoy people for Jesus. I wasn't raised to be a Jesus freak. My dad is an original Detroit player, gator shoes, women, money, running the streets. He had heard that his dad, he never met him, was a fast-talking, womanizing preacher who ran the streets. So I guess it was in my blood to run the streets in some way, except I was on the corner, hey, you want to talk to me about Jesus? I started going to this church in my early 20s, and I sold out at every service, an usher, an armor bearer, reading my Bible, living a celibate life, no women, a kid just trying my best to please God. I loved evangelism. We would go out in twos. I was paired up with the church secretary. Her name was Ethel. I love old-fashioned names. My mom's name is Bessie, and I'm a mama's boy. Ethel was fine, too. Tall, long legs, that's my thing. Amazons with vintage names. I had been celibate for 6 years at that point, but I still knew if a woman was fine, and she was, we would be out annoying heathens for Jesus together, and we weren't making people uncomfortable so much as getting comfortable with one another. And people at the church noticed that we had this chemistry together. But it was one of these churches where, like, the women at the church were Jesus's girl until you put a ring on it. So they split us up in evangelism, and the pastor told me, stop hanging around her. But stolen water tastes sweet. And bread eaten in secret is delicious. That's Proverbs 9:17, if anybody brought their Bibles, I don't know. So we were in a mutual friend's wedding, me and Ethel, and the bride paired us to walk down the aisle together because we were tall. And I remember I spun her around, and she laughed, the whole church laughed. Something about weddings. After the reception, we found ourselves alone, just me and Ethel. And we forgot about celibacy. We forgot about the pastor's rules, forgot about sin. We kissed, we touched, we held each other. And after it was done and that 6 year Jones had ended, I felt defeated. I felt like I had let God down. I remember I sat at the end of the bed while she dressed, and I felt naked. I mean, I really was naked. I hadn't put my clothes on yet, but y'all know what I'm talking about. She went to work the next day. She worked at the church. She was the secretary. And she told the pastor what happened. He calls me and tells me, come meet him at his office. I remember I walked past Ethel. She was acting busy at her desk. I went in his office and sat in his big chair. And this is a man I respected. I know he knew how bad I felt. He came in. He was like, that's why I told you not to hang around her. I knew this was going to happen. The next Sunday, at the beginning of the service, he calls me and Ethel to the front of the church. And the pastor says, tell them what happened. Full congregation, even in the balcony. And we confess our sins to everyone in detail. Ethel just stares at the ground. She says a few words. Me, I say, hey, everyone. I'm sorry for committing the sin of fornication with Ethel here. We went to the wedding. It was a nice wedding. And we were rubbing against each other. And then we had sex, and we're not married, and that's not right. I was crying and everything. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Ethel was accepted back into the fold. She was a good secretary, I guess. I was pushed out, discommunicated. Ethel never spoke to me again, ever. The pastor never spoke to me again, ever. After no communication with anyone at the church, my friends, roommates, I got the picture and left. Now, about 6 years later, and I'm gonna be honest with you, I wasn't celibate for those 6 years. I was getting it in, as they say. But about 6 years later, I saw a news report that the church went bankrupt. All the property was foreclosed on, and the church closed down. Now, I'm not saying that happened because the pastor did me wrong. I'm not saying that. It was one of these prosperity churches. The pastor was buying helicopters, jets, big houses, BMWs, stupid stuff. All this stuff, I don't know that really if that really helps people. I wonder if the pastor went in front of the whole congregation and confessed for ruining the church's finances. I doubt it. I think he just moved to Florida. If you died today, where would you go? I think heaven has to be more than just good timing with asking forgiveness. It has to be. The other day, I ran into this kid, and he asked me to talk about Jesus. And I stopped and talked to him, and I could see myself in him, trying my damnedest to live right for God and for the approval of the people around me. I prayed with him the whole nine. And after it was over and he was going to go off to annoy other people for Jesus, I said, "Hey, kid, don't be afraid to live a little. Trust me, God will still love you." And before he left, I said, hey, inside scoop, if you mess up, don't tell the whole congregation. It's really none of their business. Take them to church, folks.
Listening to Snap Judgment Live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Produced in partnership with Michigan Radio. Stay tuned. Snap Live in Ann Arbor. We're joining the show in progress.
Okay, so our next guest, in just a couple months, is going to be recording a comedy album with the same group that produced Richard Pryor's first comedy album. Maybe you didn't hear that here, but it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mr. Joe Klosik.
I am a stand-up comic, and I get an email for a gig in the Northern California town of Redding. If you don't know Redding, California, I think the best way to describe it is it's where 1972 went. The email starts out with this disclaimer. Quote, "Please be advised this venue prominently displays a Confederate flag. It's not indicative of their philosophy there. I've booked many diverse shows at this venue. Have fun." How could I not take that gig? I get up there and I'm standing outside the place. There's a doorman. I've never met him. He's never met me. First words out of his mouth to me are,
"You know, I can always tell when black people are around."
Whoa! Yeah, so can I. They're black. Are you a psychic racist? And I walk into the place, and I look up, and yes, there's a Confederate flag, but above it is the biggest American flag I've ever seen in my life. I want you to think like Chevy truck commercial, halftime at the Super Bowl, America big. And then under it is the Confederate flag, and hanging on either side of it are those naked women mudflap silhouettes. Classy, right? Hanging at the bottom of the Confederate disco ball. This is the most confused dream catcher ever. Does it come together in some way? Is there a meaning, you know?
America, if you're different, we don't want you. Women are objects, gays are okay.
I don't think that's what it meant. Right before I come on stage, the owner comes up to me and says,
"Don't make fun of the Confederate flag."
Let me tell you guys something, maybe you know. If you want a comedian to not make fun of something, don't tell him to not make fun of it. 10 minutes into the show, I look out at the crowd, I look up at the flag, and then I go, "What's up, Dukes of Hazzard fans?" That's when everything changed. This low, mean sound came out of the crowd. They hated what I had just said, and I was too busy worrying about that because out of the darkness, objects started coming at me. At first it was just a fry basket and then some fries, and then there was like a fork, and then there was a rock. A rock? Someone brought a rock in here? Why is there a rock? More stuff is coming at me. They're yelling stuff at me. "You suck! Get off the stage! Your family tree probably looks like a pretzel!" More stuff is coming at me. I'm dodging a boot, a belt buckle, a belt buckle. And they are getting me. They are getting me, and I am backing up. And then I remember, I'm a comic. I am a comic. These are my words. This is truth. I am not gonna back down. There's no way I'm gonna back down. And then they all come together to chant.
"We're number one! We're number one! We're number one! We're number one!"
Really? Because that flag means you're number two. After all the tables got put back right and the cops left and I got paid somehow, I walked out of the building and I'm headed towards my car. And like somebody had just been in an accident, all of the adrenaline drains out of me. And I suddenly realize I almost got killed back there. Those guys wanted to kill me for jokes and words. And I can feel my body shake, and I silently resolve to never put myself in that position again. I'm almost at my car when this guy gets directly in front of me. I call him a tether drunk. You know what a tether drunk is? They look like this. It looks like they're gonna fall, but they never quite do. Yeah. I'm getting dizzy just trying to keep eye contact. And he gets in my face and he goes,
"I don't like what you said about the flag, boy."
And I can feel that comic rage rise again. And I'm just like, "Why are you so proud of it? I don't take people back to my house and show them my collage of losing lottery tickets. Take it down." Yes, but you weren't there that night, were you? And I can see in his eyes, he's gonna throw a punch. And he starts to, but he's so slow and so drunk that all I have to do to avoid the punch is literally just go. His fist goes past my head. He pulls it back and I straighten up. And what makes this amazing is what this guy said next. He just looks at me and goes,
"All right, you're pretty fast, Matrix."
Our next guest is the hardest working woman in comedy. Yes, indeed. Please put your hands together for Miss Caitlin Gill.
When I was young, it's not that I was big boned. It's just that I had delicious emotions. I think it all started at church. It was never my scene, and I was always nervous. But every week, they had this big, huge box of donuts. At some point, I realized that if you are always holding half of a donut, it always looks like you're on your first donut. Even if you're on your seventh donut. It must have been a trick I learned from watching my grandpa drink scotch. It was all just baby fat. Until I wasn't a baby anymore. All of a sudden I was in high school, where there are dates and dresses and dances and all sorts of other tortures designed for the obese and the insecure. By the time I stopped trying, I had asked 13 boys to dances and heard 13 no's. That's a baker's dozen. I was sad because I was fat, and I was fat because I was sad. Now, through all this, I did manage to make some great friends. And those friends and I decided that the end of our sophomore year of high school was going to be something worth celebrating. We were going to get tickets to the biggest concert event of the summer, Live 105's BFD. BFD! The concert's so epic, they almost swear about it on the radio. We all know what that F stands for. We went to the concert, and it was amazing. We saw Erasure, and we saw the Squirrel Nut Zippers, and we saw Blur, and we saw The Cure. It was a very big deal for the 90s. After the concert, we all left the arena, went into the parking lot, and stuffed ourselves into my best friend's minivan. So full now, somebody had to sit on the floor. As we were leaving, the traffic was crazy, and everybody was hungry, so we decided to stop at a Taco Bell. Now, this decision was also made by half of the gazillion people we were just at a concert with, so the drive-through line was a little bit long. We all got out of the van, and we're just milling around in the parking lot. And when it was time to get back in, it was declared that the first to arrive back at the van would get to sit shotgun, and the last would have to sit on the floor. This resulted in a sprint, which, predictably, I lost. Of course I lost a sprint. I was stuck in a beef loaf of a body. It didn't sprint anywhere. And of course, I couldn't spend a full day without feeling like a fatty McFat-Fat. I always felt like my body kept me away from other people. This time, I literally didn't have a seat. I sat there with my sad butt on the floor of the van, sliding door open, my sad feet on the sad pavement. And that's when the van started moving. Now, what happened next only took about a second, but I had a lot of time to think about it. The van's moving. I should probably lift up my legs. Gee, you know, now that the van's moving, it seems a lot harder to lift up my legs. Hey, I never noticed how close that tire was to my leg. Oh my God, my legs! The van sucked my right leg right under the tire. I flopped out of the van, and I landed on my back. I looked down to assess the situation, and I could see that my right knee had been bent so that my foot was touching my hip. But my toes were pointing right at the sky. I realized this wasn't my only immediate concern when my gaze continued downward to discover that the minivan had come to rest on my left leg. My best friend got out of the car, winding all the way around, see what happened, and stopped short when he saw me. I looked up at him, And I said, my leg is broken. Please move your car. He ran all the way back around. He climbed back in the van. He restarted it, and he pulled it off my leg. The pain I was in was otherworldly. I had not experienced anything like it before, and I have not since. I was in shock, and the shock was making me twitch, and every twitch would just send cramps down the damaged meat in my leg. And the way it was bent, there was no fixing anything until we got to a hospital, which meant that a fireman had to stand above me and use his bare hands to bend a metal leg brace to accommodate the new curve in my leg. You know, even when you're laying on the ground grievously injured, there really is something about a man in uniform. The rest of the night gets a little fuzzy. I remember learning that morphine is a hell of a drug. It turns out that my leg wasn't broken, but my kneecap had gone from the front of my leg to the back of my leg. A doctor and a few orderlies took a running start and yanked my leg back into place. They braced me up, and they sent me home. The next morning, when I woke up, I would have given anything to have my body back the way it was the day before, when I hated it. And I have never hated my body again. I also quickly learned that crutching is a great core workout, Vicodin is an appetite suppressant, and physical therapists are very serious about their work. I lost all the weight I didn't need to carry anymore. I should make it clear that I do not endorse getting hit by a minivan as a weight loss plan. I lost 30 pounds in 10 days. That's not Weight Watchers. That's when doctors start watching your kidneys. But as terrible and painful as getting run over by a minivan was, I would not change a single thing about what happened that day. That was the event in my life that revealed my beauty to myself. It's the beauty we all share. It's the beauty of these bodies. As a bonus, it turns out that getting run over by a minivan in a Taco Bell parking lot after a concert makes a pretty good story. It's a story that when I came back to school the next year, people asked me to tell over and over and over again, and I figured out that they liked it better when it was funny. And I really, really loved making them laugh. That was half my life ago. Today, I'm a stand-up comedian. I'd like to close tonight by responding to what I think must be the best senior quote penned in any yearbook, anywhere, ever. Dear Caitlin, sorry we ran you over. Apologies accepted. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Snap Judgment live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And if you dig the show, Snap Judgment is coming live to Los Angeles, October 12th at the Nokia Theater. We've got an all-new lineup. It's our biggest show ever. Get your tickets right now at snapjudgment.org. Snap Live in Ann Arbor continues right after the break. Stay tuned.
from PRX and NPR, you're listening to Snap Judgment live in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Next, one of my personal storytelling heroes. Please put your hands together for Reeves.
Hello, Ann Arbor. I worked my way through college as a waiter. The last place I worked, this upscale bistro in Los Angeles, is where I met my oddest table ever, and I had a hex put on me. It's a Friday night. We've just opened for the evening, and two ladies walk in together. Two very pale ladies wearing very dark lace dresses. Whatever the plural of Stevie Nicks is, that's what we're talking about. I'm going to call them Black Magic Woman 1 and Black Magic Woman 2. They sit down on table 20 and they do not have a good meal. A lot of complaints with the casserole, with the herbal tea selection, and they are acting really spacey, but they're my only table at this point, so I do the usual. I give them, spacey notwithstanding, genuinely solid service. Still, when they leave, I notice they don't tip me at all. Yeah, they stiff me. Which, by the way, don't. That's no big deal. It's not even a bad omen for the night. I'm still going to make great money this shift, right? So, you know, let's do that. Good 2 hours go by. The restaurant's really hopping now. I'm back in the prep area, and the manager approaches me with this weird, stern demeanor, and he says, "Okay, buddy, hand over those keys." I say, "Well, what are we talking about?" My manager says, "I'm messing with you. Those two cranky ladies from table 20 earlier are back. This time, they say they left their keys behind and that you've got them. They're telling me it's a key ring with a pewter Merlin figurine on it. It's not in Lost and Found. Do you want to talk to them about it?" I say, "Well, no, just tell them I don't have their keys." And he goes off to do that, and I go off to do my job. I'm really busy. About 5 minutes later, I'm at the ordering terminal in the dining room, and Black Magic Woman 2 sort of materializes just right beside me. She says, "You must listen. The reason we did not tip you is because we felt you gave us inferior service, but that does not justify you taking our keys. My friend is in communion with very powerful forces, and you already have a hex on you. The only way to remove this hex is to return those keys." So I shoot my manager the save me face. He hurries over, and Black Magic Woman 2 says, "Did you search this waiter's pockets?" And I volunteer right there. "Let's do this. Apron pockets, pants pockets, front, back. No keys." Black Magic Woman 2 consults with Black Magic Woman 1, comes back over, and says, "My friend has had a vision. And be aware, my friend has solved many crimes for the LAPD with her psychic gifts. She says that this waiter has put the keys in the trash can of the employee break room. Did you look there?" Which my manager sort of jumps on and says, "I didn't look through any garbage for your missing keys. But I tell you what, if I let you do it, are we good? Either way, you find the keys, you leave. You don't find the keys, you leave." And the women agree. And so my manager takes them both back past the salad station and the dishwashers to our grungy little employee break room. And I'm so curious, I pretend to get a cheesecake out of the walk-in refrigerator so I can witness this. Black Magic Woman 1 overseeing from the doorway while Black Magic Woman 2 paws through the garbage in the employee break room trash can. And this is where events have gone too far, have certainly turned uncanny, and where I have wound up truly uncomfortably edgy, because I did take the keys.
I took the keys. But when I took the keys, I had zero intention of keeping them. None, I promise. It's just that people stiff you all the time. And people leave things behind all the time. But never in my experience, both, like these ladies had done. And I guess I just wanted them to have to encounter me once more before I handed the keys over. Smooth and gallant, even. Oh, you're back. Bet you're looking for these. There you go. Drive safe was the plan. But when my manager approached me instead of the ladies like I'd been imagining, plus he seemed to be bluffing about something, I freaked. And I hid those keys underneath the trash can of the employee break room. 5 minutes later, I'm out there on the floor pantomiming innocence, and now I'm standing with a cheesecake I do not need. And I am shaking in my waiter shoes, because it does not matter where you land on the intuition to superstition spectrum. Black magic woman one's coordinates are pinpoint. If black magic woman two lifts up the trash can, we will all see a pewter Merlin figurine holding a little pewter staff with a little fake sapphire at the tip. But she does not. And so Black Magic Woman 1 and 2 leave the upscale bistro, possibly forever. And you know who comes into the bistro? This is much later. Things have died down in the restaurant, in my rib cage. It's a Los Angeles police officer. He's got this warm, tolerant smile on his face. He says, "I know you know why I am here. I just need to hear your side of the story with this key business." So I tell him my side of the story, and the cop says, "Well, it's funny. I'm sure that woman seems pretty kooky to you, but I know her. We all know her down at the station. The stuff she does for us, it's amazing. I mean, she's not always right, but when she is spot freaking on. It would blow your mind, but it's not a science, right? So, hey, try not to be offended." And I say, "No, I mean, yes, I will try not to do what you have said to be." And that was it. That's all. Half an hour later, we closed up the restaurant, and I walked with those keys just baking in my pocket to a bus stop on the corner, my bus stop, and that's where I put the keys. I put them right under an oleander bush. Those keys were not noticeable to the average passerby, but I hoped, I certainly told myself, they were obvious enough if you knew where to look.
That's right. Get ready for our next guest, Vijay
Nathan.
She spent her entire career getting on our parents' last nerve. And today, you're going to find out why they're kind of proud of her. Please put your hands together. Vijay
Nathan.
Sensitive listeners, please note, this story contains references to sexuality.
When I was little, I loved riding in the car with my mom because she always let me control the radio. Whenever my dad drove, we had to listen to the news. But when it was just me and my mom, that station wagon was my personal disco. And I became Madonna. Lucky Star, Material Girl, Like a Virgin. That was my favorite. One time I sang the song extra loud to see if my mom knew what the words meant. Like a virgin, touched for the very first time. Lack of was as far as I got. One hand on the wheel, the other at my throat. She said, Vijay, you are not like a virgin. You are a virgin. My sisters and I weren't allowed to talk about or think about sex. According to my mom, sex is only for the Americans. Indian girls had rules. One, no haircuts. Long hair is traditional and must be braided at all times. Loose hair means you're wild or a witch. Two, no tampons. They're only for prostitutes. Or white girls. Three, no boys. They're only for prostitutes. Or white girls. My mom was the perfect Indian wife, devoted to God, husband, and home, and the best South Indian cook in all of North America. She is famous for her soft as cloud idlis, her paper-thin dosas, and her tart fish curry. And every day after school, my sisters and I knew we'd find her in the kitchen cooking dinner. And this was the time that we chose to harass her about all the things that we were never supposed to talk about. While my mom chopped onions, my oldest sister, Shanti, would begin. Hey, mommy, tell us about your wedding night. Was it fun? And I'd say, yes, mommy, what did you do? What did you wear? And my sister Indu went in for the kill. Yeah, mommy, what did you wear? Bet it was something silky. Something from Fredericks of Hollywood. Her chopping got faster and faster until finally she just broke. Such dirty, dirty, dirty girls. Nothing, I wore nothing. One day when I was about 12 years old, I went into my dad's closet in search of loose change so I could buy a Slurpee. I went into the way back of the closet, and back there, I uncovered a stack of Playboys. Yeah. And books. How to please a man, how to please a woman, how to please yourself. The joy of sex, the Kama Sutra erotic secrets. I loved being in the closet. It was so deliciously naughty and free. And I told no one about my secret, not even my sisters. Sometimes I felt guilty, though, because I knew that had my mom thought of it, this would have been rule number four. No porn. It is only for prostitutes or white girls. But I couldn't help it. Somehow I had been born with this Indian girl's body, but a white girl's mind. My mom would kill me if she knew. I mean, every day she would tell me that I would get an arranged marriage and that I would never date and that I would be pure and perfect on my wedding night. And I believed this until I went to college. There I met girls who were so carefree and liberated, they consumed men like pieces of cheese. Being Indian was hard. I wanted to be an American. So at 20 years old, even though I was the youngest girl in my family, I decided that I was going to be the first to lose my virginity. But I was going to be smart about it. I wanted a man who would be great in bed, but never break my heart. I found the perfect specimen at my summer job waitressing at the Woodmont Country Club. Kevin Williams, 23, 6'2", sexy athletic body, IQ of a mango. No chance of falling in love. So after weeks of making out in his car, I was ready to take the next step. Friday night, I went to the Safeway in the Orthodox Jewish neighborhood so I wouldn't run into anyone that I knew. There, I bought condoms, spermicide, KY jelly, and a Snickers. I didn't want to look like a total deviant to the checkout girl. Saturday night, I went to Kevin's house, and we did it. And I realized that I could have been anyone to him, and he could have been anyone to me. And I didn't feel so liberated. Nothing had changed. I was still me. Afterwards, we shared the Snickers. But I decided that I'd wait for love or marriage before I ever did it again. Now, quality time in my family is Sunday brunch at my dad's golf club. He doesn't know how to play, but he insists it's good for business contacts. After the meal, he says, "Let's take a walk, just me, Shanti, Indu, and Vijay." And immediately, I know something is up because my father never, ever physically exerts himself. I start to panic as we stumble past those happy golfing families on to a quiet dirt path. He motions for me and my sisters to sit at a picnic table, turns to my oldest sister and says, "Shanti, are you having sex?" "Dad, I'm a third year resident. I'm too tired to have sex." "Good, good girl. Indu, are you having sex?" "Dad, I'm 26 years old, still living at home. I'm thoroughly repulsed that you're asking me this question." "No, I'm not." "Good, good girl. Vijay, your mother has found something that leads her to believe that you are having sex." I had gotten rid of everything. There was nothing at home that would give me away, so I decided to stay calm, poker-faced, play the reasonable adult. "Daddy, I don't know what you're talking about. What did she find?" "She won't tell me. She said if she tells me, I will kill you." "Look, Vijay, I am a liberal guy. Not like mommy. You can tell me. Yeah? I know you kids, you go to college, you smoke, you drink, you have sex. So tell me, Vijay, are you a virgin?" I didn't want to lie to my dad because I never directly lied to my parents before. "Well, Dad, I'm almost 21. Not really a kid anymore, and I think that's just too personal to discuss." "Well then, you've answered my question." And in that moment, I could see that he was no longer looking at me, but through me. And I was losing him, losing my family, losing my place. I'd stopped being good, being the baby, being Indian. I was becoming something different, foreign, American. And I had to make a choice. Daddy, of course I've never had sex. I'm still a virgin. I'm still good. I knew it. Your mother, she's crazy. I told her, my daughters, they're not loose like the Chopra girls, but... they're from Bombay. What do you expect? And as he chattered on, I felt the fragility of my life and relief as I saw those shattered pieces moving back into place. I felt so loved, safe, whole. I felt like a virgin.
Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. We so appreciate you all coming out here tonight. But first, let me get the one who composed every single song you heard, Mr. Alex Mandel. David Brandt on the sticks. And Mr. Tim Frick on the bass. Even though this is not the news, this ain't the news, this is NPR.
Big love to the Snap Live crew, Mark Ristich, Will Urbina, Pat Mesiti-Miller, Jeanette Aguilar, and Renzo Gorio. We'd like to thank Michigan Radio, PRX, CPB, and the Ann Arbor Summer Festival. If you want to see what went down, check out the film version of this show on our website right now. Extended podcast, stuff that we had to cut out, snapjudgment.org. Much love from Snap Judgment Live.